Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Whoa, Lewis said to her, feeling more than seeing Cass's rifle plunk into the snow just short of his right leg. He felt down for it, that young elk still struggling, blowing red mist from her nostrils, her eyes so big, so deep, so shiny. And I couldn't find a shell, Lewis says to Shaney. I thought I was out, that I'd used my last up by the truck when everything was crazy.
But you had one, Shaney tells him.
Two, Lewis says back, looking down at his hands. This close he didn't need the scope or a sight.
Sorry, girl, he said, and, careful of his swelling up eye,
lined the barrel up, pulled the trigger.
That's a reading from author Stephen Graham Jones's horror novel, The Only Good Indians. Stephen is a pretty prolific author. With 22 books under his belt, most of them in the horror genre, you could almost say that he makes Stephen King look like a slacker. Almost. In The Only Good Indians, Stephen Graham Jones blends a gripping and intense classic horror narrative about regret and revenge with a social commentary about Native identity. It's a perfect example of why he is now being dubbed the Jordan Peele of horror literature. We caught up with Stephen over Zoom to talk about the novel and what he thinks of that moniker.
I think it's because I know horror really well. I do horror, but also I bring who I am into the story, onto the page. And I'm not quite happy with the way things are as regards the treatment or representation of American Indians. And so I'm always coming at that, as well as my characters are coming at a monster or a monster is coming at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your latest novel is called The Only Good Indians. Can you tell us a little bit about the storyline?
Yeah. The story is four guys up on the Blackfeet Reservation are out after elk one day, just before Thanksgiving. And they make a mistake in the field. They do something they shouldn't have done. And it's just another day in the field for them, more or less, until 10 years later, it turns out that something from that day is now hunting them.
Yeah. Well, why did you choose the elk as the animal which haunts the memories of these young men?
I guess the first reason is because their atrocity, their crime, the trespass they committed wasn't against a single animal, it was against a herd of animals. And you don't very often in November come upon a whole herd of deer or whitetail or mule deer. You will find elk bunched up together like that. So, I mean, part of it's just mechanical or logistical. But, you know, the real reason, it's probably just that since I was 12, I've been hunting elk. And when we go out for elk, we usually have mule deer and whitetail tags too, but elk is the goat. And elk are super sneaky, super smart, super fast, super tough. When you get an elk, it's only after a lot of hard work. And that to me makes them kind of special.
Is another part of the reason that elk are the goal is also because they're bigger and so you're getting more meat?
You are getting a lot more meat, yes.
Mm. How much of your own personal experience hunting elk migrated into the minds of your characters?
All of it. Since I've been hunting elk my whole life, then these guys are basically doing what I've been doing.
Yeah. Your four main characters, Ricky, Lewis, Gabriel, and Cassidy, have this inside joke about which of their actions are actions that are worthy of a good Indian. And this raises the question, what makes a good Indian? What do you think the answer is?
You know, I wanted everybody in this novel to be asking themselves that. What does it mean to be a good Indian in today's world? Because America wants us to be in a John Wayne movie, basically. They want us wearing headbands and loincloths and falling dead off the back of horses. That's not necessarily what we want, of course. We're always like struggling between the representation that's forced on us and who we want to be. And there's also situations where success in one culture is betrayal in another culture. And there's all kinds of dynamics like that, which can grind a person up. So where I wanted to land with this question, what makes a good Indian, is that there's not a single way to be a good Indian. There's 7 million different ways. And the reason there's 7 million different ways is because there's 7 million of us and growing.
Are the qualities that make a good Indian different from the qualities that make a good man of any culture?
No, I don't really think they are. No, it's not about adherence to tradition. It's not about observance of ceremony. It's not about who you marry. It's about none of that. It is about whether you kind of measure up to your own threshold for success. I think that's finally what makes a good person. And to me, that's what makes a good Indian too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was very intrigued by the way your four main characters in the novel, the way they imagine newspaper headlines about themselves when they're under a lot of pressure. For example, the very first sentence is, the headline for Richard Boss Ribs would be Indian man killed in dispute outside bar. And then the second last sentence also references headlines. What role do these recurring headlines play in your novel?
I feel like I've always heard headlines in my life, so it's really just me doing like autobiography, I guess. But the way I imagine these headlines is, this is the stereotypes or set of expectations that every Indian hears as she or he moves through their life, especially with Lewis, who's probably has the most headlines, I would guess. He's always asking himself, how do I measure up? And he's always finding that the headlines are announcing that he fails, you know, that he's not doing a good enough job.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest challenge you faced while writing The Only Good Indians?
The biggest challenge was hopping heads, going from point of view to point of view, because we're both in the Spirit of Vengeance's point of view. We're in all of the characters' heads as well. There's definitely a few characters. When you watch a slasher, when you go to see Jason or Michael or Freddy at the movie theater or streaming or wherever, there's always that moment where you're looking through the eye holes of the character's mask, or you're parting the bushes to look at the party going on. I always call that slasher cam. It's where we kind of understand that this breathing presence is stalking someone. It's a, you know, a scary thing, of course. It does a good thing to up the tension in the story. However, on the page in fiction, it's really tricky to do that because we're taught that each section gets its own point of view. You can't mix them. And so to jump heads, you have to do a different section or a chapter break. But to do that announces what you're doing, and the point of view can no longer scare the character. And so I had to drop into what feels like second person from third person, which was a trick. And finally, instead of like asking for permission or precedence to do it, I just figured I'm just going to do it, make it work.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly did. I think it worked very well. It was very effective.
Thank you.
You've said that you really only write in one genre, and that genre is called What Would I Like to Read? But besides the what Stephen Graham Jones would like to readiness of this book, there's a lot of horror you're dealing with, because that's something you explore in a lot of your novels. And you're also dealing with big themes like revenge and cultural identity. What, if anything, were you trying to do different with this novel?
You know, in this novel, I wanted to scare people. That's always, I think, as a horror writer, that's got to be your first goal, is to scare people. So that was the threshold I kept asking myself with each scene, each development, each turn, was, is this going to keep the reader off balance enough that I can then like push them over a precipice into a dark space? That was, of course, my very first thing. And you know, my second expectation I always put on my own work is, I don't want to do any damage. I don't necessarily want to like repair things, but I don't want to break anything. It's kind of like a Boy Scout thing. I don't want to leave a place any more messed up than it was.
The Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott has written about the rise of this genre called indigenous horror. And she says that this genre finds indigenous writers weaving them in the mundane horror of living in a country that dehumanizes them with fiction designed to scare readers and audiences. Do you see your work as fitting into this genre?
Yeah, no, I think it definitely does. All Indians who are doing art in the post-apocalypse, where we're definitely trying to fight for, number one, just existence, because so many people don't understand that American Indians still exist. You know, they think that we went away with covered wagons or whatever. So that's the first battle. And then the second battle is for, it's not for fair or charitable representation, I don't think. I think that's a distraction. I think it's for treaty rights, for legal stuff. You know, I think sovereignty, we need to be, that's the stuff that we always need to be angling for or looking towards.
Mm-hmm. Do you have hope that more progress will be made towards sovereignty?
I do have hope. Like that decision that was just made in Oklahoma that returned so much of the land, that's a major, major step. And I think it's going to ripple out to a lot more decisions, and things are going to slowly start to change. And if I remember correctly, a pipeline was recently denied access to some tribal lands, and that kind of stuff just thrills me to no end.
There's this shift-shaping creature called Elkhead Woman that stalks the four men. Does this character originate in Native American mythology, or is it something that you invented?
There is a deer woman, but I didn't plan on Elkhead Woman continuing that tradition necessarily. Or if it does, it's only in the sense that right before I was writing The Only Good Indians, I had a friend, Elizabeth LaFence, I had one of her comic books right here by my keyboard. And on her comic book is called Deer Woman, a vignette. And on the cover is a woman with a deer head. And so I can't imagine that that didn't influence me and make me imagine Elkhead Woman. However, really what I was trying to do with Elkhead Woman is just bring Jason Voorhees up to the reservation and see how that kind of slasher would fare against us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you certainly did that and did it in a very gripping and very scary way. What is it about slasher fiction and in film and in literature that you find so interesting?
What I like about the slasher is that wrongs are punished. And I'm not talking about wrongs like drinking, drugs, sex, partying, any of that. Like, that's a weird thing that's happened. I'm talking about treating people with compassion. Like, the way the slasher is usually built is, in sixth grade, a group of popular kids take advantage of a unpopular kid and shame him or her in the cafeteria of the school or something. And they just move on with their day. This was another bullying incident of many that they've, you know, done. However, 10 years later at the graduation or high school reunion or whatever it is, they are then made to pay for their crimes, either by a spirit of vengeance having risen as a result of that, or by that very victim empowering themselves to come back and get justice. And that's what I love about the slasher, is that those kind of wrongs are punished. Like, in the real world, you know, we all see in the news, in our daily lives, we see terrible stuff happening every day, and it's not punished. You know, there's no closure of that justice cycle. On the page in a slasher, or on screen in a slasher, I can for a moment believe that the world is a fair place.
Yeah, very well said. You have this great essay that you wrote, I'm not sure when, a few years ago anyway, called Letter to a Just Starting Out Indian Writer, and Maybe to Myself. And in this essay you write, don't ask for permission, but don't ask for forgiveness either. You're going to say things you wished you hadn't, or that you wished you'd said better. It makes me wonder, have you ever written something that you regret, that you wish you could take back?
Years ago, I did a introduction for a collection of things. And in the introduction, I mention all the different nationalities that are represented in this collection that I was, you know, talking about. And I always feel bad that somewhere in there I said I'd never heard of some of these places, because I hadn't. I thought I was being honest. And I mean, it's not bad to be honest, but at the same time, I wonder if I was from that small country in Sri Lanka or wherever it is, and I was reading that, how like disempowered would I feel knowing that somebody else did not know about my home country? And so probably like once a week in the past like 12, 13 years since I did that, I think about that and I just cringe, like I should have been better.
You also say that a good question to keep in mind while writing is, who are you writing against? So I want to ask you that. Who are you writing against in your work?
Yeah. I mean, I'm writing against people who produce fiction that's not sincere. That's my first straw man I put up. I don't consider a straw man. I consider it a quite scary meat person. I think insincere fiction pulls the whole house of fiction down. Stuff that people are writing solely for money, that they don't put their heart into, that doesn't matter to them. That just, it hurts my soul to imagine that stuff like that is on the shelf, that a reader can go to a store or a friend or wherever and pick a book off the shelf and want an experience and get something that someone didn't put their heart in. That just makes me sad.
Yeah. I understand that you create a playlist for every novel that you write. What was on your playlist for the only Good Indians?
I can't remember. I do create a playlist for all my novels. Usually I save them. Somehow I did not save my Only Good Indians playlist.
You don't find that distracting, like to hear lyrics while you're writing, while you're creating words to hear lyrics of songs?
No, I'm actually, the playlist I create have to have lyrics. I've tried instrumental pieces and I listen to those too closely. But if I choose songs that I know so intimately that I no longer have to listen to them, but I still have like emotional associations with them, like an example would be, let's see, Meatloaf, Objects in the Rearview Mirror. That finds its way onto a lot of my playlists. And I've listened to that song probably thousands of times, so I no longer have to listen to it. But once I hear it, it provokes or pulls out the same emotions from me. And those emotions are what I need for the playlist. Also, if there's words, then that does distract a part of my mind, which I consider to be the critical part of my mind. so that I can actually do some real work. Because if you're always looking over your own shoulder, imagining what are the critics going to think, what is this reader going to think, what is history going to think, then you don't actually move forward. You get too nervous. You can't write with all that attention. I think you have to write your first draft with your heart, and then you go back with your brain and revise it and make it work. But that first draft, for it to be pure, you can't have anybody looking over your shoulder, I don't think.
Stephen Graham Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Graham Jones is the author of the horror novel, The Only Good Indians. You can find out more about Stephen at wpr.org/beta.
It does say something, I think, about the kind of mutated version of the American dream that being a monster represents.
Coming up next, we celebrate the 30th anniversary of Martin Scorsese's mob masterpiece, Goodfellas, with film critic Glenn Kenny. That's after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.